When Mark Twain could be heard, he said, Mark Twain's Address. These habits of which Mr. Choate has told you are the very habits which have kept me young until I am 70 years old. I have lain in bed all day today, expect to lie in bed all day tomorrow, and will continue to lie in bed all day throughout the year. There is nothing so refreshing, nothing is so comfortable, and nothing fits one so well for the kind of work which he calls pleasure. Mr. Choate has been careful not to pay me any compliments. It wasn't because he didn't want to, he just couldn't think of any. I came here in the responsible capacity of policeman, to watch Mr. Choate. This is an occasion of grave and serious importance, and it seemed necessary for me to be present so that if he tried to work off any statements that required correction, reduction, refutation, or exposure, there would be a tried friend of the public here to protect the house. But I can say in all frankness and gratitude that nothing of the kind has happened. He has not made one statement whose veracity fails to tally exactly with my own standard. I've never seen a person improve so. This does not make me jealous. It only makes me thankful. Thankful and proud. Proud of a country that can produce such men, two such men, and all in the same century. We can't be with you always. We are passing away, passing away. Soon we shall be gone, and then, well, everything will have to stop, I reckon. It is a sad thought, but in spirit I shall still be with you. Choate, too, if he can. Nothing to refute. There being nothing to explain, nothing to refute, nothing to excuse, there is nothing left for me to do now but resume my natural trade, which is teaching. At Tuskegee, they thoroughly ground the student in the Christian code of morals. They instill into him the indisputable truth that this is the highest and best of all systems of morals, that the nation's greatness, its strength, and its repute among the other nations is the product of that system, that it is the foundation upon which rests the American character, that whatever is commendable, whatever is valuable in the individual American's character, is the flower and fruit of that seed. They teach him that this is true in every case, whether the man be a professing Christian or an unbeliever. For we have none but the Christian code of morals, and every individual is under its character-building powerful influence and dominion from the cradle to the grave. He breathes it in with his breath. It is in his blood and bone. It is the web and woof and fiber of his mental and spiritual heredities, and ineradicable. And so every born American among the 80 millions, let his creed or destitution of creed be what it may, is indisputably a Christian to this degree, that his moral constitution is Christian. Two codes of morals. All this is true, and no student will leave Tuskegee ignorant of it. Then what will he lack under his head? What is there for me to teach him under this head, that he may possibly not acquire there, or may acquire in a not sufficiently emphasized form? Why, this large fact, this important fact, that there are two separate and distinct kinds of Christian morals, so separate, so distinct, so unrelated, that they are no more kin to each other than are archangels and politicians. The one kind is Christian private morals, the other is Christian public morals. The loyal observance of Christian private morals has made this nation what it is, a clean and upright people in its private domestic life, an honest and honorable people in its private commercial life. No alien nation can claim superiority over it in these regards. No critic, foreign or domestic, can challenge the validity of this truth. During 363 days in the year, the American citizen is true to his Christian private morals, and keeps undefiled the nation's character at its best and highest. Then, in the other 2 days of the year, he leaves his Christian private morals at home and carries his Christian public morals to the tax office and the polls and does the best he can to damage and undo his whole year's faithful and righteous worth. Political morality. Without a blush, he will vote for an unclean boss if that boss is his party's Moses. Without compunction, he will vote against the best man in the whole land if he is on the other ticket. Every year, in a number of cities and states, he helps to put corrupt men in office. Every year, he helps to extend the corruption wider and wider. Year after year, he goes on gradually rotting the country's political life. Whereas, if he would but throw away his Christian public morals and carry his Christian private morals to the polls, he could promptly purify the public service and make the possession of office a high and honorable distinction, and one to be coveted by the very best men the country could furnish. But now, well, now he contemplates his unpatriotic work and sighs and grieves and blames every man but the right one, which is himself. As to tax dodgers, once a year he lays aside his Christian private morals and hires a ferry boat and piles up his bonds in a warehouse in New Jersey for 3 days, and gets out his Christian public morals and goes to the tax office and holds up his hand and swears he wishes he may never, never if he's got a cent in the world, so help him. The next day the list appears in the papers, a column and a quarter of names in fine print, and every man in the list a billionaire and a member of a couple of churches. I know all those people. I have friendly social and criminal intercourse with the whole of them. They never miss a sermon when they are so as to be around, and they never miss swearing off day, whether they are so as to be around or not. The innocent cannot remain innocent in the disintegrating atmosphere of this thing. I used to be an honest man. I am crumbling. No, I have crumbled. When they assessed me at $75,000 a fortnight ago, I went out and tried to borrow the money and couldn't. Then when I found they were letting a whole crop of millionaires live in New York at a third of the price they were charging me, I was hurt. I was indignant and said, "This is the last feather. I'm not going to run this town all by myself." In that moment, in that memorable moment, I began to crumble. Mark Twain disintegrates. In 15 minutes the disintegration was complete. In 15 minutes I was become just a mere moral sand pile, and I lifted up my hand along with those seasoned and experienced deacons and swore off every rag of personal property I've got in the world, clear down to cork leg, glass eye, and what is left of my wig. Those tax officers were moved. They were profoundly moved. They had long been accustomed to seeing hardened old grafters act like that, and they could endure the spectacle. But they were expecting better things of me, a chartered professional moralist, and they were saddened. I fell visibly in their respect and esteem, and I should have fallen in my own, except that I had already struck bottom and there wasn't any place to fall to. Does a gentleman swear off? At Tuskegee, they will jump to misleading conclusions from insufficient evidence, along with Dr. Parkhurst, and they will deceive the student with the superstition that no gentleman ever swears. Look at those good millionaires, aren't they, gentlemen? Well, they swear. Only once a year, maybe, but there's enough bulk to it to make up for the lost time. And do they lose anything by it? No, they don't. They save enough in 3 minutes to support the family 7 years. When they swear, do we shudder? No, unless they say damn, then we do. It shrivels us all up. Yet we ought not to feel so about it, because we all swear, everybody, including the ladies, including Dr. Parkhurst, that strong and brave and excellent citizen, but superficially educated. For it is not the word that is the sin, it is the spirit back of the word. When an irritated lady says, oh, the spirit back of it is damn, and that is the way it is going to be recorded against her. It always makes me so sorry when I hear a lady swear like that, but if she says damn and says it in an amiable, nice way, it isn't going to be recorded at all. The idea that no gentleman ever swears is all wrong. He can swear and still be a gentleman if he does it in a nice and benevolent and affectionate way. The historian John Fiske, whom I knew well and loved, was a spotless and most noble and upright Christian gentleman, and yet he swore once. Not exactly that, maybe. Still, he... But I will tell you about it. One day, when he was deeply immersed in his work, his wife came in much moved and profoundly distressed and said, "I am sorry to disturb you, John, but I must, for this is a serious matter and needs to be attended to at once." Then, lamenting, she brought a grave accusation against their little son. She said, "He has been saying his Aunt Mary is a fool and his Aunt Martha is a damned fool." Mr. Fiske reflected upon the matter a minute, then said, "Oh, well, it's about the distinction I should make between them myself." Mr. Washington, I beg you to convey these teachings to your great and prosperous and most beneficent educational institution, and add them to the prodigal mental and moral riches wherewith you equip your fortunate protégés for the struggle of life. Robert C. Ogden, after his introduction by Mr. Choate, said that before he began his formal address, which was financial rousement of the occasion, he wanted to answer Mark Twain's remarks on profanity. "I want to say," said Mr. Ogden, "that my friend's allusions to the ethics of profanity are not at all original. I knew all about them years ago, and he would not have known as much as he does had he never lived in Hartford. I remember hearing a distinguished Puritan say once there, banging his fist on the desk in front of him during a debate, that he'd be damned if he would allow such a proposition to go through. In answer to this, Henry Clay Trumbull said that it was fine to see a man who could say damn with such profound reverence. Mr. Ogden then went on to tell the needs of Tuskegee. He said that the best intelligence of the country, North and South, admitted the peculiar educational duty that was owing to the Negroes that had become a part of the population of the nation. Applause for Washington. Mr. Ogden said that there were three distinct appeals. An added income of $90,000 a year was needed, an added endowment of $1,800,000 was essential, and a heating plant to cost $34,000 was necessary. Just before Booker T. Washington entered the hall, a messenger boy handed him a note from Thomas Dixon, Jr., in which the writer said he would contribute $10,000 to Tuskegee if Mr. Washington would state at the meeting that he did not desire social equality for the Negro, and that Tuskegee was opposed to the amalgamation of the races. When asked what he had to say on the subject, Mr. Washington said, "I will make no answer whatever. I have nothing to say." Mr. Washington got a fine reception when he came forward to speak, and there was great applause when he said in the course of his address, "One point we might consider as settled. We are through experimenting and speculating as to where the 10 millions of black people are to live. We have reached the unalterable determination that we are going to remain here in America, and the greater part of us are going to remain for all time in the southern states. In this connection, I do not hesitate to say that from my point of view, the great body of our people find a more encouraging opportunity in the South than elsewhere. Since we are to forever constitute a part of the citizenship of this country, there is but one question to be answered. Shall we be among the best citizens or among the worst? Every race of people should be judged by its best type, not by its lowest," said Mr. Washington. "One has no right to pass judgment upon a people until he has taken the pains to see something of their progress, after they have had a reasonable chance. Wherever we have been able to reach the people through education, they have improved morally at a rapid pace, and crime has decreased. After making diligent inquiry, we cannot find a single man or woman who holds a diploma from the Hampton Institute in Virginia or the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama in the walls of a penitentiary. No two groups of people can live side by side where one is in ignorance and poverty without its condition affecting the other. The black man must be lifted, or the white man will be injured in his moral and spiritual life. The degradation of the one will mean the degradation of the other. I do not overlook the seriousness of the problem that is before us, nor do I set any limits upon the growth of my race. In my opinion, it is the most important and far-reaching problem that the nation has had before it. But you cannot make equally good citizens where, in one part of the country, a child has $1.50 expended for his education, and in another part of the country another child has $20 spent for his enlightenment. The Negro, in many ways, has proved his worth and loyalty to this country. What he now asks is that through such institutions as Hampton, Fisk, and Tuskegee, he shall be given the chance to render high and intelligent service to our country in the future. I have faith that such an opportunity will be given him." When the affair was over and the people began to climb up on the stage and pass along and shake hands, the usual thing happened. It always happens. I shake hands with people who used to know my mother intimately in Arkansas, in New Jersey, in California, in Jericho, and I have to seem so glad and so happy to meet these persons who knew in this intimate way one who was so near and dear to me. And this is the kind of thing that gradually turns a person into a polite liar and deceiver, for my mother was never in any of those places. One pretty creature was glad to see me again and remembered being at my house in Hartford. I don't know when, a great many years ago it was. Now she was mistaking me for somebody else. It couldn't have happened to her, but I was very cordial because she was very pretty. And I said, "I've been longing to meet you these many, many years, for you have been celebrated throughout all the ages. You are the unborn child. From the beginning of time, you have been used as a symbol. When people want to be emphatic, when they want to reach the utmost limit of lack of knowledge, they say, 'He is as innocent as the unborn child. He is as ignorant as the unborn child. You were not there at the time you think of, except in spirit. You hadn't arrived in the flesh. She was very nice. We might have had a good long chat, except for the others that I had to talk with and work up reminiscences that belonged in somebody else's experiences, not my own. There was one young fellow, brisk but not bright, overpoweringly pleasant and cordial in his way. He said his mother used to teach school in Elmira, New York, where he was born and bred and where the family continued to reside, and that she would be very glad to know that he had met me and shaken hands, for he said, "She is always talking about you. She holds you in high esteem, although, as she says, she has to confess that of all the boys that ever she had in her school, you were the most troublesome." "Well," I said, "those were my last school days, and through long practice in being troublesome, I had reached the summit by that time, because I was more than 33 years old." It didn't affect him in the least. I don't think he even heard what I said, he was so eager to tell me all about it, and I said to him once more, so as to spare him and me, that I was never in a schoolhouse in Elmira, New York, even on a visit, and that his mother must be mistaking me for some of the Langdons, the family into which I married. No matter, he didn't hear it, kept on his talk with animation and delight, and has gone to tell his mother, I don't know what. He didn't get anything out of me to tell her, for he never heard anything I said. These episodes used to vex me years and years ago, but they don't vex me now. I am older. If a person thinks that he has known me at some time or other, all I require of him is that he shall consider it a distinction to have known me, and then, as a rule, I am perfectly willing to remember all about it, and add some things that he has forgotten. Twitchell came down from Hartford to be present at that meeting, and we chatted and smoked after we got back home, and reference was made again to that disastrous Boston speech which I made at Whittier's 70th birthday dinner, and Joe asked me if I was still minded to submit that speech to that club in Washington day after tomorrow, where Colonel Harvey and I are to be a couple of the four guests, and I said no, I'd given that up, which was true, because I have examined that speech a couple of times since and have changed my notion about it, changed it entirely. I find it gross, coarse. Well, I needn't go on with particulars. I didn't like any part of it from the beginning to the end. I found it always offensive and detestable. How do I account for this change of view? I don't know. I can't account for it. I am the person concerned. If I could put myself outside of myself and examine it from the point of view of a person not personally concerned in it, then no doubt I could analyze it and explain to my satisfaction the change which has taken place. As it is, I am merely moved by instinct. My instinct said formerly that it was an innocent speech and funny. The same instinct, sitting cold and judicial as a court of last resort, has reversed that verdict. I expect this latest verdict to remain. May 25th. It did remain, until the day before yesterday. Then I gave it a final and vigorous reading, aloud, and dropped straight back to my former admiration of it. M.T. I don't remove the speech from the autobiography because I think that this change of mind about it is interesting, whether the speech is or not, and therefore let it stay. Twitchell had a letter with him which interested me, and by request he left it with me to be returned to him after I shall have used it. This letter is from the Reverend Charles Stowe, a son of Harriet Beecher Stowe. The letter is now about 2 months old, but in that time Joe has pretty nearly worn it out reading it to people, that is, reading a certain passage in it to people. He read that passage to me, to wit. I was reading in the volume of Reverend Dr. Burton's Remains, as the old folks used to say, your remarks at his funeral. I think for beauty of diction, richness of thought, and delicacy and strength of psychological analysis, it is up to any of the masters of our tongue. The passage I admire most of all is the one beginning, men marked the sunshine in him, etc. I think the whole thing is a gem, but this passage is a masterpiece of beautiful and dignified English. It is a shame that men like Dr. Parker and Dr. Burton are in the battle of life, in a way. No, that men like you and Dr. Burton are, in a way, like the 130-gun ships of the Spanish fleet at Trafalgar, outclassed by pygmies. And Joe said, Mark, what do you think of that? I said, well, Joe, I don't want to commit myself. Send me the passage, and then I will furnish my opinion. Joe said, you know, the charm of this whole thing lies in the fact that it wasn't I that did that wonderful gem. It was Parker. But Twitchell is getting a lot of satisfaction out of it. Some time ago, his daughters gathered together a large company of their young friends of the two sexes, and while they were in the midst of their banquet, Joe came in and greeted them and was welcomed. But necessarily, with his gray head, he was in a considerable degree in embarrassment, and the hilarity, without perhaps entirely breaking off, was diminished to the proper degree of reverence for Joe's cloth and age. That being just the right atmosphere, just the right conditions for an impressive reading of that passage in this letter, Joe read it with apparent pride and almost juvenile vanity. While those young people dropped their eyes in pity for an old man who could display his vanities in such a way and take such a childish delight in them, Joe's daughters turned crimson, glanced at each other, and were ready to cry over this humiliating exhibition. Then, of course, Twitchell finished his performance by informing them that these praises were all deserved, but not by him. For Mr. Stowe had made a mistake. If he had gone and taken another look at that passage which he so highly praised, he would have noticed that it was the work of Reverend Dr. Parker, and not of himself. At one of the Monday morning meetings of the clergy, Twitchell did the same thing, and with such excellent effect that in the midst of his reading, Parker himself spoke out and said, "Now, Joe, this is too much. We know you can do fine things. We know you can do wonderful things. But you never did anything as wonderful as this that Charlie Stowe is talking about. He is no competent critic, that is quite manifest. There isn't anything in English literature worthy of such an intemperate encomium as this that Charlie Stowe is passing on your Burton speech." Then Joe explained that Parker was only damaging himself because it was Parker's speech he was reading about. Parker is still in the harness. He has been shepherd of the same congregation, its children and its grandchildren and its great-grandchildren, for 46 years. Joe says he is just as marvelous an artist in English phrasing and just as fine and deep in thought as ever he was. To my knowledge, this is saying a great deal. For Parker was one of our remarkable men when I knew him in the old Hartford days, and we had 8 or 10 men in that town who were way above the average. Twitchell's congregation, the only congregation he has ever had since he entered the ministry, celebrated the 40th anniversary of his accession to that pulpit a couple of weeks ago. Joe entered the army as chaplain in the very beginning of the Civil War. He was a young chap and had just been graduated from Yale and the Yale Theological Seminary. He made all the campaigns of the Army of the Potomac. When he was mustered out, that congregation I am speaking of called him, and he has served them ever since, and always to their satisfaction, except once. I have found among my old manuscripts one which I perceive to be about 22 years old. It has a heading and looks as if I had meant it to serve as a magazine article. I can clearly see now why I didn't print it. It is full of indications that its inspiration was what happened to Twitchell about that time, and which produced a situation for him which he will not forget until he is dead, if he even forgets it then. I think I can see, all through this artful article, that I was trying to hint at Twitchell, and the episode of that preacher whom I met on the street, and hint at various things that were exasperating me. And now that I read that old article, I perceive that I probably saw that my art was not ingenious enough, that I hadn't covered Twitchell up and hadn't covered up the episode that I was hinting at, that anybody in Hartford could read everything between the lines that I was trying to conceal. I will insert this venerable article in this place and then take up that episode in Joe's history and tell about it. The character of man. Concerning man. He is too large a subject to be treated as a whole, so I will merely discuss a detail or two of him at this time. I desire to contemplate him from this point of view, this premise, that he was not made for any useful purpose for the reason that he hasn't served any, that he was most likely not even made intentionally, and that his working himself up out of the oyster bed to his present position was probably matter of surprise and regret to the Creator. For his history, in all climes, all ages, and all circumstances, furnishes oceans and continents of proof that of all the creatures that were made, he is the most detestable. Of the entire brood, he is the only one, the solitary one, that possesses malice. That is the basest of all instincts, passions, vices, the most hateful. That one thing puts him below the rats, the grubs, the trichini. He is the only creature that inflicts pain for sport, knowing it to be pain. But if the cat knows she is inflicting pain when she plays with the frightened mouse, then we must make an exception here. We must grant that, in one detail, man is the moral peer of the cat. All creatures kill. There seems to be no exception. But of the whole list, man is the only one that kills for fun. He is the only one that kills in malice, the only one that kills for revenge. Also, in all the list, he is the only creature that has a nasty mind. Shall he be extolled for his noble qualities, for his gentleness, his sweetness, his amiability, his lovingness, his courage, his devotion, his patience, his fortitude, his prudence, the various charms and graces of his spirit? The other animals share all these with him, yet are free from the blacknesses and rottennesses of his character. There are certain sweet-smelling, sugar-coated lies current in the world, which all politic men have apparently tacitly conspired together to support and perpetuate. One of these is that there is such a thing in the world as independence, independence of thought, independence of opinion, independence of action. Another is that the world loves to see independence, admires it, applauds it. Another is that there is such a thing in the world as toleration, in religion, in politics, and such matters. And with it trains that already mentioned auxiliary lie that toleration is admired and applauded. Out of these trunk lies spring many branch ones, to wit, the lie that not all men are slaves, the lie that men are glad when other men succeed, glad when they prosper, glad to see them reach lofty heights, sorry to see them fall again. And yet other branch lies, to wit, that there is heroism in man, that he is not mainly made up of malice and treachery, that he is sometimes not a coward, that there is something about him that ought to be perpetuated, in heaven or hell or somewhere. And these other branch lies, to wit, that conscience, man's moral medicine chest, is not only created by the Creator, but is put into man ready charged with the right and only true and authentic correctives of conduct, and the duplicate chest with the self-same correctives, unchanged, unmodified, distributed to all nations and all epochs. And yet one other branch lie, to wit, that I am I and you are you, that we are units, individuals, and have natures of our own, instead of being the tail end of a tapeworm eternity of ancestors extending in linked procession back, and back, and back, to our source in the monkeys, with this so-called individuality of ours a decayed and rancid mush of inherited instincts and teachings, derived atom by atom, stench by stench, from the entire line of that sorry column, and not so much new and original matter in it as you could balance on a needle point and examine under a microscope. This makes well-nigh fantastic the suggestion that there can be such a thing as a personal, original, and responsible nature in a man, separable from that in him which is not original, and findable in such quantity as to enable the observer to say, "This is a man, not a procession." Consider that first-mentioned lie, that there is such a thing in the world as independence, that it exists in individuals, that it exists in bodies of men. Surely, if anything is proven by whole oceans and continents of evidence, it is that the quality of independence was almost wholly left out of the human race. The scattering exceptions to the rule only emphasize it, light it up, make it glare. The whole population of New England meekly took their turns for years in standing up in the railway trains, without so much as a complaint above their breath, till at last these uncounted millions were able to produce exactly one single independent man, who stood to his rights and made the railroad give him a seat. Statistics and the law of probabilities warrant the assumption that it will take New England 40 years to breed his fellow. There is a law with a penalty attached forbidding trains to occupy the Asylum Street crossing more than 5 minutes at a time. For years, people in carriages used to wait there nightly as much as 20 minutes on a stretch, while New England trains monopolized that crossing. I used to hear men use vigorous language about that insolent wrong, but they waited just the same. We are discreet sheep. We wait to see how the drove is going and then go with the drove. We have two opinions, one private, which we are afraid to express, and another one, the one we use, which we force ourselves to wear to please Mrs. Grundy until habit makes us comfortable in it, and the custom of defending it presently makes us love it, adore it, and forget how pitifully we came by it. Look at it in politics. Look at the candidates whom we loathe 1 year and are afraid to vote against the next, whom we cover with unimaginable filth 1 year and fall down on the public platform and worship the next. and keep on doing it until the habitual shutting of our eyes to last year's evidences brings us presently to a sincere and stupid belief in this year's. January 11th, thought 6. It is long ago, but it plainly means Blaine, M.T. Look at the tyranny of party, at what is called party allegiance, party loyalty, a snare invented by designing men for selfish purposes, and which turns voters into chattels, slaves, rabbits. And all the while, their masters and they themselves are shouting rubbish about liberty, independence, freedom of opinion, freedom of speech, honestly unconscious of the fantastic contradiction. And forgetting or ignoring that their fathers and the churches shouted the same blasphemies a generation earlier when they were closing their doors against the hunted slave, beating his handful of humane defenders with Bible texts and billies, and pocketing the insults and licking the shoes of his southern master. If we would learn what the human race really is at bottom, we need only observe it in election times. A Hartford clergyman met me in the street and spoke of a new nominee, denounced the nomination in strong, earnest words, words that were refreshing for their independence, their manliness. January 11th, thought 6. I can't remember his name. It began with K, I think. He was one of the American revisers of the New Testament and was nearly as great a scholar as Hammond Trumbull. He said, I ought to be proud, perhaps, for this nominee is a relative of mine. On the contrary, I am humiliated and disgusted, for I know him intimately, familiarly, and I know that he is an unscrupulous scoundrel and always has been. You should have seen this clergyman preside at a political meeting 40 days later and urge and plead and gush, and you should have heard him paint the character of this same nominee. You would have supposed he was describing the Cid and Greatheart and Sir Galahad and Bayard the Spotless all rolled into one. Was he sincere? Yes, by that time. And therein lies the pathos of it all, the hopelessness of it all. It shows at what trivial cost of effort a man can teach himself a lie and learn to believe it, when he perceives by the general drift that that is the popular thing to do. Does he believe his lie yet? Oh, probably not. He has no further use for it. It was but a passing incident. He spared to it the moment that was its due, then hastened back to the serious business of his life. And what a paltry poor lie is that one which teaches that independence of action and opinion is prized in men, admired, honored, rewarded. When a man leaves a political party, he is treated as if the party owned him, as if he were its bond slave, as most party men plainly are, and had stolen himself, gone off with what was not his own. And he is traduced, derided, despised, held up to public obloquy and loathing. His character is remorselessly assassinated. No means, however vile, are spared to injure his property and his business. The preacher who casts a vote for conscience' sake runs the risk of starving, and is rightly served, for he has been teaching a falsity, that men respect and honor independence of thought and action. Mr. Beecher may be charged with a crime, and his whole following will rise as one man and stand by him to the bitter end. But who so poor to be his friend when he is charged with casting a vote for conscience' sake? Take the editor so charged. Take anybody. All the talk about tolerance in anything or anywhere is plainly a gentle lie. It does not exist. It is in no man's heart. But it unconsciously and by moss-grown inherited habit drivels and slobbers from all men's lips. Intolerance is everything for oneself and nothing for the other person. The mainspring of man's nature is just that, selfishness. Let us skip the other lies for brevity's sake. To consider them would prove nothing except that man is what he is, loving toward his own, lovable to his own, his family, his friends, and otherwise the buzzing, busy, trivial enemy of his race, who tarries his little day, does his little dirt, commends himself to God, and then goes out into the darkness to return no more and send no messages back. Selfish even in death. Thursday, February 1st, 1906. Subject of January 24th continued. Mr. Twitchell's unpopular vote. Joe was not quite present. It was not etiquette for him to be within hearing of the business talks concerning the church's affairs. He remained in the seclusion of the church parlor, ready to be consulted if that should be necessary. The congregation was present in full force. Every seat was occupied. The moment the house was called to order, a member sprang to his feet and moved that the connection between Twitchell and the church be dissolved. The motion was promptly seconded. Here and there and yonder, all over the house, there were calls of question, question. But Mr. Hubbard, a middle-aged man, a wise and calm and collected man, business manager and part owner of the Current, rose in his place and proposed to discuss the motion before rushing it to a vote. The substance of his remarks was this, which I must put in my own language, of course, as I was not there. Mr. Twitchell was the first pastor you ever had. You have never wanted another until 2 months ago. You have had no fault to find with his ministrations as your pastor, but he has suddenly become unfit to continue them because he is unorthodox in his politics, according to your views. Very well, he was fit. He has become unfit. He was valuable. His value has passed away, apparently, but only apparently. His highest value remains, if I know this congregation. When he assumed this pastorate, this region was an outlying district, thinly inhabited, its real estate worth next to nothing. Mr. Twitchell's personality was a magnet which immediately began to draw population in this direction. It has continued to draw it from that day to this. As a result, your real estate, almost valueless in the beginning, ranges now at very high prices. Reflect before you vote upon this resolution. The church in West Hartford is waiting upon this vote with deep solicitude. That congregation's real estate stands at a low figure. What they are anxious to have now above everything else, under God, is a price raiser. Dismiss Mr. Twitchell tonight, and they will hire him tomorrow. Prices there will go up. Prices here will go down. That is all. I move the vote. Twitchell was not dismissed. That was 22 years ago. It was Twitchell's first pulpit after his consecration to his vocation. He occupies it yet, and has never had another. The 40th anniversary of his accession to it was celebrated by that congregation and its descendants a couple of weeks ago, and there was great enthusiasm. Twitchell has never made any political mistakes since. His persistency in voting right has been an exasperation to me these many years, and has been the cause and inspiration of more than one vicious letter from me to him. But the viciousness was all a pretense. I have never found any real fault with him for voting his infernal Republican ticket, for the reason that, situated as he was, with a large family to support, his first duty was not to his political conscience, but to his family conscience. A sacrifice had to be made. A duty had to be performed. His very first duty was to his family, not to his political conscience. He sacrificed his political independence and saved his family by it. In the circumstances, this was the highest loyalty and the best. If he had been a Henry Ward Beecher, it would not have been his privilege to sacrifice his political conscience, because in case of dismissal, 1,000 pulpits would have been opened to him, and his family's bread secure. In Twitchell's case, there would have been some risk, in fact a good deal of risk, that he or any other expert could have raised the prices of real estate in West Hartford is, to my mind, exceedingly doubtful. I think Mr. Hubbard worked his imagination to the straining point when he got up that scare that night. I believe it was safest for Twitchell to remain where he was if he could. He saved his family, and that was his first duty, in my opinion. In this country, there are perhaps 80,000 preachers. Not more than 20 of them are politically independent. The rest cannot be politically independent. They must vote the ticket of their congregations. They do it and are justified. They themselves are mainly the reason why they have no political independence, for they do not preach political independence from their pulpits. They have their large share in the fact that the people of this nation have no political independence. February 1, 1906. Tomorrow will be the 36th anniversary of our marriage. My wife passed from this life 1 year and 8 months ago in Florence, Italy, after an unbroken illness of 22 months' duration. I saw her first in the form of an ivory miniature in her brother Charlie's stateroom in the steamer Quaker City in the Bay of Smyrna, in the summer of 1867, when she was in her 22nd year. I saw her in the flesh for the first time in New York in the following December. She was slender and beautiful and girlish, and she was both girl and woman. She remained both girl and woman to the last day of her life. Under a grave and gentle exterior burned inextinguishable fires of sympathy, energy, devotion, enthusiasm, and absolutely limitless affection. She was always frail in body, and she lived upon her spirit, whose hopefulness and courage were indestructible. Perfect truth, perfect honesty, perfect candor were qualities of her character which were born with her. Her judgments of people and things were sure and accurate. Her intuitions almost never deceived her. In her judgments of the characters and acts of both friends and strangers, there was always room for charity, and this charity never failed. I have compared and contrasted her with hundreds of persons, and my conviction remains that hers was the most perfect character I have ever met. And I may add that she was the most winningly dignified person I have ever known. Her character and disposition were of the sort that not only invite worship, but command it. No servant ever left her service who deserved to remain in it. And as she could choose with a glance of her eye, the servants she selected did in almost all cases deserve to remain, and they did remain. She was always cheerful, and she was always able to communicate her cheerfulness to others. During the 9 years that we spent in poverty and debt, she was always able to reason me out of my despairs and find a bright side to the clouds and make me see it. In all that time, I never knew her to utter a word of regret concerning our altered circumstances, nor did I ever know her children to do the like. For she had taught them, and they drew their fortitude from her. The love which she bestowed upon those whom she loved took the form of worship, and in that form it was returned by relatives, friends, and the servants of her household. It was a strange combination which wrought into one individual, so to speak, by marriage, her disposition and character, and mine. She poured out her prodigal affections in kisses and caresses, and in a vocabulary of endearments whose profusion was always an astonishment to me. I was born reserved as to endearments of speech and caresses, and hers broke upon me as the summer waves break upon Gibraltar. I was reared in that atmosphere of reserve. As I have already said in an earlier chapter, I never knew a member of my father's family to kiss another member of it except once, and that at a deathbed. And our village was not a kissing community. The kissing and caressing ended with courtship, along with the deadly piano playing of that day. She had the heart-free laugh of a girl. It came seldom, but when it broke upon the ear, it was as inspiring as music. I heard it for the last time when she had been occupying her sickbed for more than a year, and I made a written note of it at the time, a note not to be repeated. Tomorrow will be the 36th anniversary. We were married in her father's house in Elmira, New York, and went next day by special train to Buffalo, along with the whole Langdon family, and with the Beechers and the Twitchells, who had solemnized the marriage. We were to live in Buffalo, where I was to be one of the editors of the Buffalo Express, and a part owner of the paper. I knew nothing about Buffalo, but I had made my household arrangements there through a friend, by letter. I had instructed him to find a boarding house of as respectable a character as my light salary as editor would command. We were received at about 9 o'clock at the station in Buffalo, and were put into several sleighs and driven all over America, as it seemed to me, for apparently we turned all the corners in the town and followed all the streets there were, I scolding freely and characterizing that friend of mine in very uncomplimentary words for securing a boarding house that apparently had no definite locality. But there was a conspiracy, and my bride knew of it, but I was in ignorance. Her father, Jervis Langdon, had bought and furnished a new house for us in the fashionable street, Delaware Avenue, and had laid in a cook and housemaids and a brisk and electric young coachman, an Irishman, Patrick McAleer. And we were being driven all over that city in order that one sleighful of those people could have time to go to the house and see that the gas was lighted all over it, and a hot supper prepared for the crowd. We arrived at last, and when I entered that fairy place, my indignation reached high water mark, and without any reserve I delivered my opinion to that friend of mine for being so stupid as to put us into a boarding house whose terms would be far out of my reach. Then Mr. Langdon brought forward a very pretty box and opened it and took from it a deed of the house. So the comedy ended very pleasantly, and we sat down to supper. The company departed about midnight, and left us alone in our new quarters. Then Ellen, the cook, came in to get orders for the morning's marketing, and neither of us knew whether beefsteak was sold by the barrel or by the yard. We exposed our ignorance, and Ellen was full of Irish delight over it. Patrick McAleer, that brisk young Irishman, came in to get his orders for next day, and that was our first glimpse of him. 36 years have gone by, and this letter from Twitchell comes this morning from Hartford. Hartford, January 31st. Dear Mark, I am sorry to say that the news about Patrick is very bad. I saw him Monday. He looked pretty well and was in cheerful spirits. He told me that he was fast recovering from an operation performed on him last week Wednesday, and would soon be out again. But a nurse who followed me from the room when I left told me that the poor fellow was deceived. The operation had simply disclosed the fact that nothing could be done for him. Yesterday I asked the surgeon, Johnson, living opposite us, if that were so. He said yes, that the trouble was cancer of the liver and that there was no help for it in surgery. The case was quite hopeless. The end was not many weeks off. A pitiful case indeed. Poor Patrick. His face brightened when he saw me. He told me, the first thing, that he had just heard from Jean. His wife and son were with him. Whether they suspect the truth, I don't know. I doubt if the wife does, but the son looked very sober. Maybe he only has been told. Yours affectionately, Joe. Jean had kept watch of Patrick's case by correspondence with Patrick's daughter, Nancy, and so we already knew that it was hopeless. In fact, the end seems to be nearer than Twitchell suspects. Last night I sent Twitchell word that I knew Patrick had only a day or two to live, and he must not forget to provide a memorial wreath and pin a card to it with my name and Clara's and Jean's, signed to it, worded, "In loving remembrance of Patrick McAleer, faithful and valued friend of our family for 36 years. I wanted to say that he had served us 36 years, but some people would not have understood that. He served us constantly for 26 years. Then came that break when we spent 9 or 10 years in Europe. But if Patrick himself could see his funeral wreath, then I should certainly say in so many words that he served us 36 years. For last summer, when we were located in the New Hampshire hills at Dublin, we had Patrick with us. Jean had gone to Hartford the 1st of May and secured his services for the summer. Necessarily, a part of our household was Katie Leary, who has been on our roster for 26 years, and one day Jean overheard Katie and Patrick disputing about this length of service. Katie said she had served the family longer than Patrick had. Patrick said it was nothing of the kind, that he had already served the family 10 years when Katie came, and that he had now served it 36 years. He was just as brisk there in the New Hampshire hills as he was 36 years ago. He was 64 years old, but was just as slender and trim and handsome and just as alert and springy on his feet as he was in those long-vanished days of his youth. He was the most perfect man in his office that I have ever known, for this reason, that he never neglected any detail, howsoever slight, of his duties, and there was never any occasion to give him an order about anything. He conducted his affairs without anybody's help. There was always plenty of feed for the horses. The horses were always shod when they needed to be shod. The carriages and sleighs were always attended to. He kept everything in perfect order. It was a great satisfaction to have such a man around. I was not capable of telling anybody what to do about anything. He was my particular servant, and I didn't need to tell him anything at all. He was just the same in the New Hampshire hills. I never gave him an order while he was there the whole 5 months, and there was never anything lacking that belonged in his jurisdiction. When we had been married a year or two, Patrick took a wife, and they lived in a house which we built and added to the stable. They reared 8 children. They lost one 2 or 3 years ago, a thriving young man, assistant editor of a Hartford daily paper, I think. The children were all educated in the public schools and in the high school. They are all men and women now, of course. Our first child, Langdon Clemens, was born the 7th of November, 1870, and lived 22 months. Susie was born the 19th of March, 1872, and passed from life in the Hartford home the 18th of August, 1896. With her, when the end came, were Jean and Katie Leary and John and Ellen, the gardener and his wife. Clara and her mother and I arrived in England from around the world on the 31st of July and took a house in Guildford. A week later, when Susie, Katie, and Jean should have been arriving from America, we got a letter instead. Friday, February 2nd, 1906. Subject of February 1st continued. The death of Susie Clemens. Ends with mention of Dr. John Brown. It explained that Susie was slightly ill, nothing of consequence. But we were disquieted and began to cable for later news. This was Friday. All day, no answer, and the ship to leave Southampton next day at noon. Clara and her mother began packing to be ready in case the news should be bad. Finally came a cablegram saying, "Wait for cablegram in the morning." This was not satisfactory, not reassuring. I cabled again, asking that the answer be sent to Southampton, for the day was now closing. I waited in the post office that night till the doors were closed, toward midnight, in the hope that good news might still come, but there was no message. We sat silent at home till 1 in the morning, waiting for we knew not what. Then we took the earliest morning train, and when we reached Southampton, the message was there. It said the recovery would be long but certain. This was a great relief to me, but not to my wife. She was frightened. She and Clara went aboard the steamer at once and sailed for America to nurse Susie. I remained behind to search for another and larger house in Guildford. That was the 15th of August, 1896. 3 days later, when my wife and Clara were about halfway across the ocean, I was standing in our dining room thinking of nothing in particular when a cablegram was put into my hand. It said, "Susie was peacefully released today." It is one of the mysteries of our nature that a man, all unprepared, can receive a thunderstroke like that and live. There is but one reasonable explanation of it. The intellect is stunned by the shock but gropingly gathers the meaning of the words. The power to realize their full import is mercifully wanting. The mind has a dumb sense of vast loss. That is all. It will take mind and memory months and possibly years to gather together the details and thus learn and know the whole extent of the loss. A man's house burns down. The smoking wreckage represents only a ruined home that was dear through years of use and pleasant associations. By and by, as the days and weeks go on, first he misses this, then that, then the other thing. And when he casts about for it, he finds that it was in that house. Always it is an essential. There was but one of its kind. It cannot be replaced. It was in that house. It is irrevocably lost. He did not realize that it was an essential when he had it. He only discovers now when he finds himself balked, hampered by its absence. It will be years before the tale of lost essentials is complete, and not till then can he truly know the magnitude of his disaster. The 18th of August brought me the awful tidings. The mother and the sister were out there in mid-Atlantic, ignorant of what was happening, flying to meet this incredible calamity. All that could be done to protect them from the full force of the shock was done by relatives and good friends. They went down the bay and met the ship at night, but did not show themselves until morning, and then only to Clara. When she returned to the stateroom, she did not speak and did not need to. Her mother looked at her and said, "Susie is dead." At 10:30 that night, Clara and her mother completed their circuit of the globe and drew up at Elmira by the same train and in the same car which had borne them and me westward from it 1 year, 1 month, and 1 week before. And again Susie was there, not waving her welcome in the glare of the lights as she had waved her farewell to us 13 months before, but lying white and fair in her coffin in the house where she was born. The last 13 days of Susie's life were spent in our own house in Hartford, the home of her childhood and always the dearest place in the earth to her. About her she had faithful old friends, her pastor, Mr. Twitchell, who had known her from the cradle and who had come a long journey to be with her, her uncle and aunt, Mr. and Mrs. Theodore Crane, Patrick, the coachman, Katie, who had begun the service when Susie was a child of 8 years, John and Ellen, who had been with us many years, also Jean was there. At the hour when my wife and Clara set sail for America, Susie was in no danger. 3 hours later, there came a sudden change for the worse. Meningitis set in, and it was immediately apparent that she was death-struck. That was Saturday, the 15th of August. That evening, she took food for the last time, Jean's letter to me. The next morning, the brain fever was raging. She walked the floor a little in her pain and delirium, then succumbed to weakness and returned to her bed. Previously, she had found hanging in a closet a gown which she had seen her mother wear. She thought it was her mother, dead, and she kissed it and cried. About noon she became blind, an effect of the disease, and bewailed it to her uncle. From Jean's letter I take this sentence, which needs no comment. About 1 in the afternoon Susie spoke for the last time. It was only one word that she said when she spoke that last time, and it told of her longing. She groped with her hands and found Katie, and caressed her face, and said, "Mama." How gracious it was that in that forlorn hour of wreck and ruin, with the night of death closing around her, she should have been granted that beautiful illusion, that the latest vision which rested upon the clouded mirror of her mind should have been the vision of her mother, and the latest emotion she should know in life the joy and peace of that dear imagined presence. About 2 o'clock she composed herself as if for sleep, and never moved again. She fell into unconsciousness, and so remained 2 days and 5 hours, until Tuesday evening at 7:07, when the release came. She was 24 years and 5 months old. On the 23rd, her mother and her sisters saw her laid to rest, she that had been our wonder and our worship. In one of her own books, I find some verses which I will copy here. Apparently, she always put borrowed matter in quotation marks. These verses lack those marks, and therefore I take them to be her own. Love came at dawn when all the world was fair, when crimson glories, bloom, and song were rife. Love came at dawn when hope's wings fanned the air and murmured, "I am life." Love came at even when the day was done, when heart and brain were tired and slumber pressed. Love came at eve, shut out the sinking sun, and whispered, "I am rest." The summer seasons of Susie's childhood were spent at Quarry Farm on the hills east of Elmira, New York, the other seasons of the year at the home in Hartford. Like other children, she was blithe and happy, fond of play. Unlike the average of children, she was at times much given to retiring within herself and trying to search out the hidden meanings of the deep things that make the puzzle and pathos of human existence, and in all the ages have baffled the inquirer and mocked him. As a little child, aged 7, she was oppressed and perplexed by the maddening repetition of the stock incidents of our race's fleeting sojourn here, just as the same thing has oppressed and perplexed maturer minds from the beginning of time. A myriad of men are born. They labor and sweat and struggle for bread. They squabble and scold and fight. They scramble for little mean advantages over each other. Age creeps upon them. Infirmities follow. Shames and humiliations bring down their prides and their vanities. Those they love are taken from them, and the joy of life is turned to aching grief. The burden of pain, care, misery grows heavier year by year. At length ambition is dead. Pride is dead. Vanity is dead. Longing for release is in their place. It comes at last, the only unpoisoned gift earth ever had for them, and they vanish from a world where they were of no consequence, where they achieved nothing, where they were a mistake and a failure and a foolishness, where they have left no sign that they have existed, a world which will lament them a day and forget them forever. Then another myriad takes their place and copies all they did and goes along the same profitless road and vanishes as they vanished, to make room for another and another and a million other myriads to follow the same arid path through the same desert and accomplish what the first myriad and all the myriads that came after it accomplished. Nothing. "Mama, what is it all for?" asked Susie, preliminarily stating the above details in her own halting language, after long brooding over them alone in the privacy of the nursery. A year later, she was groping her way alone through another sunless bog, but this time she reached a rest for her feet. For a week, her mother had not been able to go to the nursery evenings at the child's prayer hour. She spoke of it, was sorry for it, and said she would come tonight, and hoped she could continue to come every night and hear Susie pray as before. Noticing that the child wished to respond, but was evidently troubled as to how to word her answer, she asked what the difficulty was. Susie explained that Miss Foote, the governess, had been teaching her about the Indians and their religious beliefs, whereby it appeared that they had not only a god, but several. This had set Susie to thinking. As a result of this thinking, she had stopped praying. She qualified this statement, that is, she modified it, saying she did not now pray in the same way as she had formerly done. Her mother said, "Tell me about it, dear." "Well, Mama, the Indians believed they knew, but now we know they were wrong. By and by it can turn out that we are wrong. So now I only pray that there may be a God and heaven, or something better." I wrote down this pathetic prayer in its precise wording at the time, in a record which we kept of the children's sayings, and my reverence for it has grown with the years that have passed over my head since then. Its untaught grace and simplicity are a child's, but the wisdom and the pathos of it are of all the ages that have come and gone since the race of man has lived and longed and hoped and feared and doubted. To go back a year, Susie aged 7. Several times her mother said to her, "There, there, Susie, you mustn't cry over little things." This furnished Susie a text for thought. She had been breaking her heart over what had seemed vast disasters, a broken toy, a picnic canceled by thunder and lightning and rain, the mouse that was growing tame and friendly in the nursery caught and killed by the cat. And now came this strange revelation. For some unaccountable reason, these were not vast calamities. Why? How is the size of calamities measured? What is the rule? There must be some way to tell the great ones from the small ones. What is the law of these proportions? She examined the problem earnestly and long. She gave it her best thought from time to time for 2 or 3 days, but it baffled her, defeated her, and at last she gave up and went to her mother for help. "Mama, what is little things?" It seemed a simple question at first, and yet before the answer could be put into words, unsuspected and unforeseen difficulties began to appear. They increased, they multiplied, they brought about another defeat. The effort to explain came to a standstill. Then Susie tried to help her mother out, with an instance, an example, an illustration. The mother was getting ready to go downtown, and one of her errands was to buy a long-promised toy watch for Susie. "If you forgot the watch, Mama, would that be a little thing?" She was not concerned about the watch, for she knew it would not be forgotten. What she was hoping for was that the answer would unriddle the riddle and bring rest and peace to her perplexed little mind. The hope was disappointed, of course, for the reason that the size of a misfortune is not determinable by an outsider's measurement of it, but only by the measurements applied to it by the person specially affected by it. The king's lost crown is a vast matter to the king, but of no consequence to the child. The lost toy is a great matter to the child, but in the king's eyes, it is not a thing to break the heart about. A verdict was reached, but it was based upon the above model, and Susie was granted leave to measure her disasters thereafter with her own tape line. I will throw in a note or two here touching the time when Susie was 17. She had written a play modeled upon Greek lines, and she and Clara and Margaret Warner and other young comrades had played it to a charmed house full of friends in our house in Hartford. Charles Dudley Warner and his brother George were present. They were near neighbors and warm friends of ours. They were full of praises of the workmanship of the play, and George Warner came over the next morning and had a long talk with Susie. The result of it was this verdict: "She is the most interesting person I have ever known of either sex." Remark of a lady, Mrs. Cheney, I think, author of the biography of her father, Reverend Dr. Bushnell. "I made this note after one of my talks with Susie. She knows all there is of life and its meanings. She could not know it better if she had lived it out to its limit. Her intuitions and ponderings and analyzings seem to have taught her all that my 60 years have taught me." Remark of another lady. She is speaking of Susie's last days. "In those last days, she walked as if on air, and her walk answered to the buoyancy of her spirits and the passion of intellectual energy and activity that possessed her." I return now to the point where I made this diversion. From her earliest days, as I have already indicated, Susie was given to examining things and thinking them out by herself. She was not trained to do this. It was the make of her mind. In matters involving questions of fair or unfair dealing, she reviewed the details patiently and surely arrived at a right and logical conclusion. In Munich, when she was 6 years old, she was harassed by a recurrent dream in which a ferocious bear figured. She came out of the dream each time sorely frightened and crying. She set herself the task of analyzing this dream. The reasons of it? The purpose of it? The origin of it? No, the moral aspect of it. Her verdict, arrived at after candid and searching investigation, exposed it to the charge of being one-sided and unfair in its construction. For, as she worded it, she was never the one that ate, but always the one that was eaten. Susie backed her good judgment in matters of morals with conduct to match, even upon occasions when it caused her sacrifice to do it. When she was 6 and her sister Clara was 4, the pair were troublesomely quarrelsome. Punishments were tried as a means of breaking up this custom. These failed. Then rewards were tried. A day without a quarrel brought candy. The children were their own witnesses, each for or against her own self. Once Susie took the candy, hesitated, then returned it, with the suggestion that she was not fairly entitled to it. Clara kept hers, so here was a conflict of evidence, one witness for a quarrel and one against it. But the better witness of the two was on the affirmative side, and the quarrel stood proved and no candy due to either side. There seemed to be no defense for Clara, yet there was, and Susie furnished it, and Clara went free. Susie said, "I don't know whether she felt wrong in her heart, but I didn't feel right in my heart." It was a fair and honorable view of the case, and especially acute analysis of it for a child of 6 to make. There was no way to convict Clara now except to put her on the stand again and review her evidence. There was a doubt as to the fairness of this procedure, since her former evidence had been accepted and not challenged at the time. The doubt was examined and canvassed. Then she was given the benefit of it and acquitted, which was just as well, for in the meantime, she had eaten the candy anyway. Whenever I think of Susie, I think of Marjorie Fleming. There was but one Marjorie Fleming. There can never be another. No doubt I think of Marjorie when I think of Susie mainly because Dr. John Brown, that noble and beautiful soul, rescuer of marvelous Marjorie from oblivion, was Susie's great friend in her babyhood, her worshiper and willing slave. In 1873, when Susie was 14 months old, we arrived in Edinburgh from London, fleeing thither for rest and refuge after experiencing what had been to us an entirely new kind of life. 6 weeks of daily lunches, teas, and dinners away from home. We carried no letters of introduction. We hid ourselves away in Betch's Family Hotel in George Street and prepared to have a comfortable season all to ourselves. But by good fortune, this did not happen. Straightway, Mrs. Clemens needed a physician, and I stepped around to 23 Rutland Street to see if the author of Rab and His Friends was still a practicing physician. He was. He came, and for 6 weeks thereafter we were together every day, either in his house or in our hotel. Monday, February 5th, 1906. Dr. John Brown continued, incidents connected with Susie Clemens's childhood, bad spelling, etc. His was a sweet and winning face, as beautiful a face as I have ever known, reposeful, gentle, benignant, the face of a saint at peace with all the world and placidly beaming upon it the sunshine of love that filled his heart. Dr. John was beloved by everybody in Scotland, and I think that on its downward sweep southward it found no frontier. I think so because when, a few years later, infirmities compelled Dr. John to give up his practice, and Mr. Douglas, the publisher, and other friends set themselves the task of raising a fund of a few thousand dollars, whose income was to be devoted to the support of himself and his maiden sister, who was in age. The fund was not only promptly made up, but so very promptly that the books were closed before friends 100 miles south of the line had had an opportunity to contribute. No public appeal was made. The matter was never mentioned in print. Mr. Douglas and the other friends applied for contributions by private letter only. Many complaints came from London and everywhere between from people who had not been allowed an opportunity to contribute. This sort of complaint is so new to the world, so strikingly unusual, that I think it worthwhile to mention it. Dr. John was very fond of animals, and particularly of dogs. No one needs to be told this who has read that pathetic and beautiful masterpiece, Rab and His Friends. After his death, his son, Jock, published a little memorial of him which he distributed privately among the friends, and in it occurs a little episode which illustrates the relationship that existed between Dr. John and the other animals. It is furnished by an Edinburgh lady whom Dr. John used to pick up and carry to school or back in his carriage frequently at a time when she was 12 years old. She said that they were chatting together tranquilly one day when he suddenly broke off in the midst of a sentence and thrust his head out of the carriage window eagerly, then resumed his place with a disappointed look on his face. The girl said, "Who is it? Someone you know?" He said, "No, a dog I don't know." He had two names for Susie, Wee Wifey and Megalopis. This formidable Greek title was conferred in honor of her big brown eyes. Susie and the doctor had a good deal of romping together. Daily he unbent his dignity and played bear with the child. I do not now remember which of them was the bear, but I think it was the child. There was a sofa across a corner of the parlor with a door behind it opening into Susie's quarters, and she used to lie in wait for the doctor behind the sofa. Not lie in wait, but stand in wait, for you could only get just a glimpse of the top of her yellow head when she stood upright. According to the rules of the game, she was invisible, and this glimpse did not count. I think she must have been the bear, for I can remember two or three occasions when she sprang out from behind the sofa and surprised the doctor into frenzies of fright, which were not in the least modified by the fact that he knew that the bear was there and was coming. It seems incredible that Dr. John should ever have wanted to tell a grotesque and rollicking anecdote. Such a thing seems so out of character with that gentle and tranquil nature that... But no matter. I tried to teach him the anecdote, and he tried his best for two or three days to perfect himself in it, and he never succeeded. It was the most impressive exhibition that ever was. There was no human being, nor dog, of his acquaintance in all Edinburgh that would not have been paralyzed with astonishment to step in there and see Dr. John trying to do that anecdote. It was one which I have told some hundreds of times on the platform, and which I was always very fond of, because it worked the audience so hard. It was a stammering man's account of how he got cured of his infirmity, which was accomplished by introducing a whistle into the midst of every word which he found himself unable to finish on account of the obstruction of the stammering. And so his whole account was an absurd mixture of stammering and whistling, which was irresistible to an audience properly keyed up for laughter. Dr. John learned to do the mechanical details of the anecdote, but he was never able to inform these details with expression. He was preternaturally grave and earnest all through, and so when he fetched up with the climaxing triumphant sentence at the end, but I must quote that sentence or the reader will not understand. It was this. The doctor told me that whenever I wanted to hammer, I must whistle. And I did, and it cured me entirely. The doctor could not master that triumphant note. He always gravely stammered and whistled and stammered it through, and it came out at the end with the solemnity and the gravity of the judge delivering sentence to a man with the black cap on. He was the loveliest creature in the world, except his aged sister, who was just like him. We made the round of his professional visits with him in his carriage every day for 6 weeks. He always brought a basket of grapes, and we brought books. The scheme which we began with on the first round of visits was the one which was maintained until the end, and was based upon this remark which he made when he was disembarking from the carriage at his first stopping place to visit a patient. "Entertain yourselves while I go in here and reduce the population."